This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 15th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 273. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. The big deal feature. Vancouver International Airport's boss on the hot seat. Members of Parliament grilled Tamara Vrooman about the Christmas time chaos at Canada's Pacific Gateway. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or does British Columbia's law that allows citizens to fire their MLAs between elections need reform? If Elections BC greenlights a citizen's petition under the recall law, the citizen has just over 2 months to sign up 40% of a riding's eligible voters who also voted in the previous election. In Vancouver Point Grey, Salvatore Vitro is looking for 16,449 or more people who meet that criteria to sign his petition by the March 20th deadline. Vitro wants to recall the Premier, David Eby, over the controversial reform to health regulation that the NDP majority passed in the fall. Eby has won 3 elections in Vancouver Point Grey since 2013, and his honeymoon period as Premier is still young. In 2020, Eby kept the riding with more than 12,600 votes, a 51.3% share. Don't expect Eby to lose any sleep over this one. The NDP has its critics, inside and outside the party, but there is no critical mass, no throw-the-bums-out sentiment just yet. There have been 27 recall petitions since 1997, and only once did citizens meet the 40% quota. They actually exceeded it in 1998 against BC Liberal MLA Paul Reitsma in Parksville-Qualicum. He was the MLA who famously wrote letters to the editor of the local newspaper in praise of himself, under the pseudonym Warren Betanko. Instead of being fired and becoming the answer to a BC politics history trivia question, Reitsma quit. So Elections BC officially counts that one as a failed campaign. So don't be surprised if Vitro's petition against Eby makes it 0-28. It shouldn't be too easy to get rid of an MLA, because political foes would abuse the law. But it shouldn't be too hard either. Instead of the 40% quota over 2 months, how about changing it? How about 3 months to get 30% of eligible signatures on the petition? What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The rest of Canada takes delight in teasing Vancouverites about snow. Lower mainlanders get relatively little snow compared to those in Edmonton and Winnipeg or Toronto, but every few years a snowstorm causes grief and brief chaos for Lotuslanders. Vancouver got walloped in December 1965, 1968, 1990, and 1996. Some even called December 1996's storm of the century. The one in December 2008 was particularly embarrassing because the Winter Olympics were coming to Vancouver in just over a year. Vancouver International Airport bought a new fleet of snowplows just in case, but they weren't needed in February 2010. Though, the airport authority has boasted ever since that it's ready for anything. Well, in December 2022, it happened again. The week of December 18th, officials at Vancouver International Airport were not ready. Hundreds of flights were delayed or canceled. Holiday plans were ruined for travelers that were hoping to reunite after 2 years apart during the pandemic. The media couldn't find YVR's chief executive, Tamara Vrooman, for the first few days. She later held daily media briefings and said the airport was finding hotel rooms for stranded travelers. On January 12th, YVR CEO Tamara Vrooman testified before a House of Commons committee studying the Christmastime chaos at Canadian airports. The first voice you'll hear is Taylor Bachrach, the NDP Member of Parliament for Skeena, Bulkley Valley, BC.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to direct my questions to Ms. Vrooman from the Vancouver Airport Authority. And and add to the discussion around these challenging events. I believe it was around December 22nd, the evening in which we had one of the more alarming stories of the holiday season with passengers on board an Air Canada flight stuck on the airplane for over 11 hours and unable to deplane. Now, I've seen a communication from an individual that has worked in the airline industry, including in emergency response, and they say that it's their opinion that YVR should have implemented an emergency action plan to get the Air Canada passengers off that aircraft. Is an emergency action plan something that was discussed or considered at some point during those 11 hours?
Thanks very much for the question. Throughout, starting on the 18th of December and going throughout the week to the 23rd and actually beyond to the 27th, we had full irregular operations and emergency operations plans stood up throughout. And on the specific issue of delays on the tarmac, of course, that was our number one priority, was to be able to work with the airlines, with ground crews, to get those passengers safely off as soon as possible. As I mentioned earlier, that effort requires the coordination and the capability to tow aircraft. The airport authority does not have that authority, nor that capability, nor that responsibility. That is the responsibility of airlines. So we rely on airlines through their contracted ground handling crew to move aircraft off gates. And normally, of course, that works very well. They come onto an a gate, they move off. You might also, in this case, we came to a ground stop and we had no gating capability, as was noted. You might wonder, though, why we didn't use air stairs. I've been asked several times, you know, why we didn't have buses and air stairs available. We certainly stood up buses and air stair capabilities immediately. However, it was the opinion of our airside safety officer that due to the congested conditions on the airfield and the snow, that it was unsafe to have passengers depart. We evaluated that situation on an hourly basis until the conditions improved such that we could safely deplane people using air stairs, and then we did proceed to do that, thus clearing up the congestion. I totally agree. Unacceptable delays for that amount of time, which is why we've put the changes in place that will require aircraft to be on the gate only for a limited time and demonstrate to us that they have the towing capacity to remove those aircraft.
Now, Ms. Vrooman, you've pointed to towing capacity as one of the constraints that prevented you from getting those passengers off the aircraft, and towing capacity is a responsibility of the airline. Now, were those tow vehicles able to access the gate, given the amount of snow, and you know, appreciating that snow removal is the responsibility of the airport?
Yeah, absolutely. We did clear the taxiways, the runways, and the aprons for towing as a priority. That actually created some issues with respect to baggage handling because we prioritized towing.
If I hear you correctly, Ms. Vrooman, you made it so that the tow vehicles were able to access the gates, access the aircraft, but the airlines chose not to tow aircraft, which was required in order for people to deplane?
I wouldn't say they chose not to. I would say that they had capacity constraints in order to do that. Of course, it is in the interest, as we heard from the carriers, to get those passengers off the planes as soon as possible. But we did have a weather event here, which meant it was difficult for some staff, ground handling staff, to get into the airport. That is an area that struggles with retention of labor. And we already had maximum overtime hours being recorded across our 7 contracted ground handlers. So that combination made the scarcity of both equipment and staff, meaning it was difficult to tow aircraft in the usual and timely way.
To preparedness, I'm curious. I know that YVR has a climate plan. I'm curious if that climate plan includes strategies around adaptation and extreme weather events, you know, understanding that extreme weather is going to become a more frequent reality. Prior to the incident that we're discussing, did YVR have contingency plans for snowstorms? And if so, what weather parameters were those contingency plans based on?
Thank you. Yes, we do have a climate plan, and it does include resiliency and adaptation. As I mentioned, that included, for example, we are located on a floodplain, and while snow is difficult for an airport, water is equally so. And so during the atmospheric river, we were the only transportation hub in the province that was fully functional for those 10 days because of the work that we did to strengthen our drainage, diking, and ditch system. When it comes to snow, we do plan for snow. We had a significant snow event which shut down our region on November 29th. The airport remained operational throughout, save for a brief period on the north runway when we had an EVA aircraft that was stopped for a short period of time. We do stress test against forecasts. We discuss those forecasts with our airport community, which includes carriers, which includes CATSA, CBSA, all of those that come together to support.
Thank you very much, Ms. Vrooman. Thank you very much, Mr. Bachrach. Next, we have Mr. Doherty. Mr. Doherty, the floor is yours. You have 5 minutes.
Next, to ask questions of Tamara Vrooman, is Todd Doherty, the Conservative MP for Cariboo Prince George, BC.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll direct a majority of my questions to Ms. Vrooman. I, like many Canadians and Christmastime travelers, was stuck in Vancouver Airport waiting for a rescheduled flight. I sat with my wife on an aircraft. I was one of the fortunate ones. We were only on the aircraft for 4.5 hours waiting for de-icing fluid. The pilot came on board, and said that YVR wants to hold on to the passengers a little bit longer as they have run out of de-icing fluid. Ms. Vrooman, you have a fancy video that the end remark says, let it snow, we're ready for winter at YVR. Aeromag conducts your de-icing services on YVR. I'm very familiar with the airport ecosystems. They have 15 de-icing trucks and 10 communal de-icing bays. How can they run out of de-icing fluid?
Yeah, thank you very much for the question, and I'm sorry to hear about your experience. It's obviously not the one that we would want, particularly at that time of year. As I said, at no point did we or Aeromag run out of de-icing fluid. What does happen, though, as you're very familiar, you know, it's constant communication when de-icing is happening. We did have a period where we had a combination of snow accumulation, ice, and freezing rain.
I'm sorry, I had to cut you off again. I only have 5 minutes.
Sure.
It was a clear day, and they ran out of de-icing fluid. We were in the de-icing line, and the Aeromag had to return. The comment was that YVR's run out of de-icing fluid.
I can't speak to that comment. We certainly did not run out of de-icing fluid. You might imagine you have to go and refill the trucks from time to time, depending on
how many de-icing trucks does the Aeromag have. Do they still have 15 de-icing trucks?
They have several. I can get that exact number for you.
Can you do that by the end of the day, please?
Of course.
Thank you. Now, Ms. Vrooman, there are 1,322 nonstop destinations weekly that YVR serves throughout the world. Is that correct?
Yes.
BC alone, 518 nonstop flights per week. Is that correct?
That sounds about right. Yep.
And that includes also medevac and air ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
Were there medevac and air ambulance flights that were canceled or delayed during this time? And were there any loss of life or medical services denied or delayed?
I am aware of no loss of life, no denial of medical services, and full operation of medevac flights.
Okay. It has been said that a number of times now that there is, shared responsibility going back and forth. One of the challenges that airports face is in ramping up, obviously, would be restricted area passes, ramp passes for all of the whole ecosystem that serves. Is the aviation industry still facing some of these challenges?
We did face those challenges significantly in the summer. We have cleared up that backlog, and we did bring on extra escort staff because we knew that the movement, timely movement of equipment and people would be critical during these operations. And so we were able to provide escorts as needed to the airfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Vrooman, earlier you said that food and beverages could have been transferred to the aircraft if a request had been received from the airlines, but that no request was received. I'm wondering two things. First of all, logistically, how would YVR get food and beverage to the aircraft for the passengers who were stranded on the tarmac? And secondly, given that YVR was acutely aware that there were planes with passengers stranded on board for 11 hours, was an offer ever made by YVR to the airlines to resupply food and beverage on board?
Thank you. So we certainly were in constant communication with all of the airlines throughout that period, as I said, starting on the 18th and all the way through the week. We would have assessed, had we been asked, the situation similar to the medical evacuation question that was asked earlier, depending on the location of the aircraft and the conditions around it. We'd have trained emergency personnel that could provide. We certainly were constantly asking what support they needed, and airlines were saying uncategorically they needed access to the gates, and so that was our priority.
Vrooman, it seems like we have a situation here where the resilience plans of the airport really fell down under the pressure of this extreme weather event. I'm wondering about the role of the federal government. Are there federal regulations to ensure operational resilience during extreme weather events? And should those regulations be revisited in light of what happened at YVR?
Certainly, we have regulations that govern safe safety for irregular operations. I think what we're seeing here and the changes that we've made already in advance of our full review speak to the fact that in irregular operations, there needs to be clear authority and communication around demand management, around reduced flight schedules, and around capacity to ensure that that capacity is made available as predicted in the plan. So we certainly see opportunities for clarity in policy and regulation that focuses on those areas.
I asked officials at Vancouver International Airport where the snow equipment was parked when the storm approached. Spokesperson Elisa Smith answered, and she said by email that its own equipment is kept inside the secure zone at the airport, but it also relies on contractors who bring additional equipment from outside the secure zone. The airport boasts the region's best weather radar systems and experts. I'm seeking more answers from YVR about why it was caught short. Also, if you work at the airport and have information to provide, please contact me in confidence. I want to hear from you about what you know and what you saw. Go to thebreaker.news and click on the contact link, or email bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, Taiwan should have enough missiles to destroy Shanghai if China invades. U.S. should arm Taiwan with abundance of missiles with range to reach Shanghai and threaten its destruction, said a retired general. U.S. think tank Center for Strategic and International Studies heard that the risk of China losing its cultural and financial center would weigh heavily on Xi Jinping and crew. Deterrence would establish sufficient uncertainty regarding success and or consequences in the minds of People's Liberation Army commanders to convince them not to invade Taiwan. In Kyoto news, Japan, Canada vow to boost security ties amid China's military threat. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and his Canadian counterpart Justin Trudeau agreed Thursday that the two countries will bolster security cooperation. Kishida's trip to Canada was the fourth stop on his week-long tour of G7 countries in Europe and in North America in the run-up to the May gathering. In December, Japan decided to significantly boost its defense spending amid threats from North Korea, Russia, and China. In Hong Kong Free Press, Hong Kong working on improving SEO for official government sites following national anthem sport blunders. Google has refused a government request to manipulate search results to ensure March of the Volunteers appears at the top spot. A protest song, Glory to Hong Kong, was played at sporting events instead of the national anthem, allegedly due to incorrect Google results. In response to a lawmaker's question on Wednesday, the authorities urged citizens to visit government websites for, quote, accurate information. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.news podcast.
Now it's next time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Mail Tribune, storied newspaper in Medford, to abruptly shut down. Publisher and CEO Stephen Saslow announced the newspaper's abrupt closure on its website, saying that unused paid subscriptions would be refunded. The Mail Tribune dates to the late 1800s through a predecessor, but produced the first edition as the Medford Mail Tribune in 1907. In 1934, it won a Pulitzer Prize for public service, the first news organization in Oregon to do so. The citation came in response to the paper's campaign against unscrupulous politicians in Jackson County. In the Seattle Times, record-breaking year for whale sightings in Salish Sea. Biggs killer whales and humpback whales were the most frequently documented whales, with sightings on more than 270 days. There were more than 1,200 unique sightings of Biggs killer whales throughout the Salish Sea in 2022, according to the Orca Behavior Institute. That's 154 more sightings than in 2021 and double the number of their sightings in 2017. On a single day in 2022, a record number of more than 70 Biggs orcas was sighted from the Hood Canal to Vancouver Island. In Czech news, Old Vic Fish and Chips, another long-standing Victoria business, lost. The shop at 1316 Broad Street in Victoria will close after 90 years, but the owners say they are keeping an eye out for another location to hopefully reopen elsewhere. For now, it is part of a handful of long-standing businesses that have called it quits in the last 12 months. Stevenson's Shoe Clinic and Capital Iron closed last year. Greg's Furniture Store is looking for a new location due to downtown crime. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
the Association of Families of Flight PS752 Victims. Thousands of people marched down Lonsdale in North Vancouver on January 8th to mark the third anniversary of the Iranian military shooting down the Ukrainian Airlines jet that killed all 176 innocent people. May the families get the justice that they deserve, and may the people of Iran get democracy and freedom.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 15th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 15th of January in 1892, Canadian Dr. James Naismith published the original 13 rules of basketball? Rule number one, the ball may be thrown in any direction with one or both hands. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.